Thanks for tuning in. So, do you live in the 70% of the country that is experiencing serious drought right now? Dear God, how about this, huh? This hour is being sponsored by Bob Milton. Thank you, Bob. It is Wednesday night, church night, on the Malloy program. We call it church night because it's Wednesday night. Traditionally, if you are a fundamentalist Christian of certain denominations, you go to church on Wednesday night and pray, have prayer meeting. At least my grandparents took me to do that. And it was it was an awe-inspiring event every time we did it. So in recognition of that, as I've told this story a million times, on Wednesday, we do church night to some degree. We don't devote the whole program. Matter of fact, probably very little of the program to church night. But we do acknowledge Wednesday night is prayer meeting night, especially here in the South. When I have to make a last-minute run to the local Crossroads store not far from here, I usually go by, well, 6 or 7, maybe 15 or 20 little churches, and some predominantly white, some predominantly black. But on nights like this, with the heat down here as high as it is, front doors to these small churches would be open, and if you drive slowly, you can hear the singing and, you know, the preaching, and then they start the prayer meeting. Now, when I went to prayer meeting, it was just showed up, park the car, go in the church, climb the steps, go to the upper room, and have a seat, wait for the preacher to come up. Wednesday night, prayer meeting. It's church night on the Malloy Show. I got an email from Crispin Sands in Seattle. He sent me something here in honor of church night. So, from Crispin, when I was growing up in a fundamentalist Baptist church, we kids were encouraged to sign a creature called the Purity Oath. I never had that. It was a written promise stipulating that we would not have sex until married, and that said sex would strictly be targeted toward reproduction. Never mind that the Tabernacle Baptist Church consisted primarily of parents, children, siblings, first and second cousins, and so forth. We were pretty much all related by blood and therefore disinclined to get too cozy with each other. But I suspect that Brother Leon and the elders thought we might take the Old Testament a little too seriously and start running around in the family gene pool, rather like Lot's daughters. I bring this up because the Purity Oath has made a comeback with all barrels blazing. Back in the 60s and early 70s, when I was exposed to the concept, it was either ridiculed or ignored by more mainstream faiths. However, as the years have rolled on by, those self-same mainstream churches have adopted the Purity Oath as their own and often throw parties known, somewhat unfortunately, as Purity Balls. Let that sink in for a second. Yeah, I've heard of those, Crispin. That's where the fathers and the daughters go dance. Back to Crispin. Today, much as it was back in my day, the Purity Oath was designed to ensure that a woman's vagina, and particularly her hymen, were in the possession of her husband. This is why Purity Oaths are so much more a serious issue among girls than it is among boys. The pressure put on girls is truly awesome, especially as they approach adolescence, and the associated guilt, if one violates one jot or tittle of the promise, it can be shattering. Nowadays, the Purity Pledge can buy, you know, the person who makes the Purity Oath, the pledge, can buy a so-called Purity Ring to publicly display her commitment. Zales offers 21 options, ranging in price from $50 to $200. Gordon's offers the same range, and the upscale James Avery chain carries 14 varieties. We sure as hell weren't privy to purity rings when I was signing my oath. It's just an illustration of how mainstream the practice has become. Back in the days before the religious right and megachurches, only a few crackpot faiths like that I grew up in took this stuff seriously. Now, the movement is so large that jewelry companies can find reason to jump on the bandwagon. Please understand that I'm not promoting sex among kids. I'm only trying to say that, one, these oaths and such like exist in spades, and two, they are detrimental to the kids they affect. I would cite a study in the January 2008 issue of Pediatrics that unequivocally states that teenagers signing purity oaths, or pledges, as the article calls them, are just as likely to have sex as their more secular peers. However, I can state without hesitation that breaking one of those oaths at, say, the age of 15 or 16 burdens the youngster with a whole world of guilt. Around 95% of all Americans have premarital sex. Why saddle even one of them with sex as guilt and shame? It is time to return the vaginas to the rightful users and leave them alone to do what they may. Have sex without having babies? Eek! Offer them to other women? Gasp! Or play with them solo? Shriek! Always yours, Crispin Sands, Seattle. Well, thank you, Crispin. And I would like to thank whoever came up with the biological terms, the clinical terms for different body parts. You know, when you stop and think about it, the clinical terms for a male or female human sexual parts, the words are just so ugly, aren't they? They're all hard consonants, and you know, there's nothing smooth or cool about sexual body parts. I mean, think of the words. I'm not going to say them on the radio, but you just think of them. I mean, I've already said a couple tonight, but you think of the words. Do they make you think of fun or pleasure or relaxation or you know, good times? Or do they make you think of pointy, sharp things and bad places and V's and P's and S's and, you know, just, eh. Oh, well. Thanks, Crispin, for a great show opener tonight. We appreciate it. We don't have a break yet. I mentioned last week that Bill McKibben, the person who is trying to save the human race and save the planet, one of many, had written an article for Rolling Stone. It is out now. It is online. You should go read it. It's called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. If you don't do anything else, please go to rollingstone.com and read Bill McKibben's not too lengthy article there. Now, there is something that he wrote in the article that I would like to share with you when we return from this break. But somebody said, who had read this article, said, why don't you read the whole thing on the air? And no, I want you to read it where you can take your time and absorb what Bill McKibben has written. It's not completely horrifying in its content, but I recommend you read it. It's called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
She said, don't give me no lines and keep your hands to yourself. Let's go.
nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. So here is a very small part of Bill McKibben's article, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, that is in the current issue of Rolling Stone. You can read it online. He's talking about the profits that the five biggest oil companies have made since 2000. They've made more than $1 trillion in profits. And as he points out, there's simply too much money to be made on oil and gas and coal to try to act responsibly. But this is what he says. Much of that profit stems from a single historical accident. Alone among businesses, the fossil fuel industry is allowed to dump its main waste, carbon dioxide, for free. Nobody else gets that break. If you own a restaurant, you have to pay someone to cart away your trash, since piling it in the street would breed rats. But the fossil fuel industry is different, and for sound historical reasons. Until a quarter century ago, almost no one knew that CO2 was dangerous. But now that we understand that carbon is heating the planet and acidifying the oceans, its price becomes a central issue. If you put a price on carbon, though, through a direct tax or other methods, it would enlist markets in the fight against global warming. Once Exxon, for example, has to pay for the damage its carbon is doing to the atmosphere, the price of its products would rise. Consumers would get a strong signal to use less fossil fuel. Every time they stopped at the pump, they'd be reminded that you don't need a semi-military vehicle to go to the grocery store. The economic playing field would now be a level one for non-polluting energy sources. And you could do it all without bankrupting citizens. A so-called fee and dividend scheme would put a hefty tax on coal and gas and oil, and then simply divide up the proceeds, sending everyone in the country a check each month for their share of the added cost of carbon. By switching to cleaner energy sources, most people would actually come out ahead. There's only one problem. Putting a price on carbon would reduce the profitability of the fossil fuel industry. After all, the answer to the question, how high should the price of carbon be? The answer is high enough to keep those carbon reserves, coal and oil and gas, that would take us past 2 degrees rise in global temperature safely in the ground. The higher the price on carbon, the more of those reserves would be worthless. The fight in the end is about whether the industry will succeed in its fight to keep its special pollution break alive past the point of climate catastrophe, or whether, in the economist's parlance, will make them internalize those externalities. Now, I had never considered that, what Bill McKibben wrote about the fossil fuel industry is the only industry that is just dumps its refuse. Now, I know a lot of people say, well, so does the nuclear power industry. And that's essentially true. But the nuclear power industry is not dumping it into the atmosphere. And that's a whole different argument, I think. But what McKibben is trying to say is that coal, gas, and oil, due to the fact that the byproduct of burning this stuff is carbon dioxide, that they're just dumping it into the atmosphere for everyone to deal with. And in the process, they're killing the planet. McKibben lays out a possible solution to all this in this Rolling Stone article. There's also some fairly frightening numbers in here, the terrifying numbers that he's talking about in the title. But if you don't read anything else and you do have a computer, I would strongly recommend that you go to rollingstone.com and read this article written by Bill McKibben, who sometimes it seems, although this is not true, but it seems like McKibben is the only person on earth who's trying to save the earth. Now, I know that's not true. Of course, there are many organizations, many individuals doing their damnedest to wake us all up. But McKibben is the one to risk his freedom, to risk his sanity, I think, to keep fighting this fight. So please do that. Global Warming's Terrifying New Math by Bill McKibben in the current issue of Rolling Stone. You can, if you don't subscribe to Rolling Stone, it's at rollingstone.com. All right? Would you do that? For your old Uncle Mike, we'll be right back. Is being sponsored by Bob Milton. Thank you, Bob. Hey, you know, I don't do commercials that often. You know, there are just a couple products that are advertised in this program that I put my personal endorsement on. Anything that comes from Alice in Heel and Hollers has my 100% endorsement. But we have a new one here, Nova Joint. You've heard me talk about it. And I don't lie. This is the truth. We have been getting testimonials from people about this product. I mean, people have been writing to the company. And they have asked if, you know, they can use some of this in their promotions. And, of course, we've said yes. But I've got one here. And this is for people, you know, if you're 25, you probably don't have a problem. So this is not targeted toward you. Although, if you're sports-minded and you're athletic, you know, you can develop some joint pain. Anyway, a guy named Sam wrote this. I want to thank Mike for introducing Nova Joint to me. I'm now on my 7th bottle. I'm phasing out chondroitin / glucosamine products and relying solely on Nova Joint. I have felt an improvement in pain and discomfort since I started taking Nova Joint. Thanks to Mike Malloy and to you at Nova Joint. So if you're thinking about trying this product, I'm on board with this. And I think the people who listen to this program who've been trying it are also. So, again, you don't hear me endorse products that often, very seldom. But here's one that I think if you have need for something like this, you ought to try it. Okay? From the BBC... The environmental correspondent for the BBC, Richard Black, he wrote, oh, God, a rift in the Antarctic rock as deep as the Grand Canyon is increasing ice melt from that continent, researchers now say. A UK team found the Ferrigno, F-E-R-R-I-G-N-O, the Ferrigno Rift, They found it using ice-penetrating radar and showed that it's about 1.5 kilometers or 1 mile deep. Now, this has nothing to do with ice. This is in the rock underneath the ice in the Antarctic. The BBC writes, Antarctica is home to a geological rift system where new crust is being formed, meaning the eastern and western halves of the continent are slowly separating. The team writes in Nature, a journal, that the canyon is bringing more warm seawater to the ice sheet, which is hastening the melt. The Ferrigno Rift lies close to the Pine Island Glacier, where NASA scientists found a giant crack last year, but the newly discovered feature is not thought to be influencing the PIG, Pine Island Glacier, P-I-G, as it is known. The rift lies beneath the Ferrigno Ice Stream on a stretch of coast so remote that it has only been visited once previously. The British Antarctic Survey, BAS, project revisited the area 2 years ago. Geologist Robert Bingham of Aberdeen University led this team. The plan was to make ground observations that could link to the satellite data showing unexpectedly pronounced ice loss from the area, and they couldn't figure it out. The team towed ice-penetrating radar kit behind a snowmobile. They covered 2,500 kilometers or 1,500 miles. Dr. Bingham said, quote, what we found is that lying beneath the ice, there's a large valley, parts of which are approximately a mile deeper than the surrounding landscape. If you stripped away all of the ice here today, you'd see a feature every bit as dramatic as the huge rift valleys you see in Africa and in size as significant as the Grand Canyon in the United States. This is at odds with the flat ice surface that we were driving across. Without these measurements, we would never have known it was there. The shape of the rift is shown in a radar cross-section of ice and underlying rock that you can see if you go to BBC's website. Anyway, the Ferrigno Rift extends into a seabed trough called Belgica. The scientists suggest that during ice ages, when sea levels were much lower than at present, the rift would have channeled a major ice stream through the trough. Now, they suggest, the roles are reversed, with the walls of the Belgica trough channeling relatively warm seawater back to the ice edge. And the nearby Pine Island Glacier appears ready to calve a 900-square-kilometer iceberg. Jesus, 900-square-kilometer iceberg. Penetrating between the Antarctic bedrock and the ice that lies on it and lubricating where they join, the water allows ice to flow faster into the sea. Another professor with the British Antarctic Survey said, quote, we know that the ice loss from the West Antarctic ice sheet is governed by delivery of warm water and that the warm water is coming along channels that were previously scoured by glaciers. So the geology and the present rate of ice loss are intricately linked, and they feed back. If you have fast-flowing ice that delivers ice to the edge where it can be impacted by warm water, and warm water makes the ice flow faster, he told BBC News. Ice loss from West Antarctica is believed to contribute about 10% to global sea level rise. But how the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets respond to warmer temperatures is the biggest unknown by far in trying to predict how fast the water will rise over the coming century and beyond. A total melt of either sheet would raise global sea levels or would raise sea levels globally by several meters. East Antarctica, by contrast, is so cold that the ice is projected to remain solid for centuries. Professor Vaughn said, quote, since the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in 2007, which highlighted uncertainties connected with ice sheets, almost every significant piece of research we've produced has increased the significance of the ocean for West Antarctica and Greenland. There are changes in precipitation now and in the future, but the really big, potentially fast changes are connected to the oceans. Do, 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 do. No, it's not Twilight Zone. It's, well, isn't that, to me, it's very, very interesting that Antarctica, beneath all that ice, is this huge, mile-deep rift that is expanding and pushing. Of course, we're talking about geological terms here, so I'm sure what? I have no idea how fast or slowly it's pushing two halves of Antarctica apart, but I'll guarantee you it is, to coin a phrase, glacially slow. You know, it's kind of like continental drift. Well, not like continental drift. That's incredibly slow. But this is being pushed and expanded by the warm seawater flowing into this rift, ice melting. See, this is the problem. This is why it is madness for us, being the human race and all of our scientists, not to be addressing global climate change. Because we don't know how quickly this deterioration, in this case of Antarctic ice, or this rise in sea level temperature, we don't know how quickly or how deeply it's going to impact global weather, coastal areas around the country, island nations, coastal areas around the globe, island nations. The acidification of the oceans, that all of this brought to us courtesy of increased carbon in the atmosphere. And even people who don't want to acknowledge that it's man-made, I mean, what do you think is going on? You people who, what's the term, anthropogenic, that don't believe this stuff is being caused by the byproduct of our burning fossil fuels, even if you don't want to believe that, okay, then what do you think is causing it? Are you going to tell me it's God? Are you going to tell me it's just natural cycles? Okay, are you as prepared to die, whether it's a natural cycle or man-made, or your God deciding to call you home? I mean, please.
Can I introduce a catheter? Siphon up your life. Talk radio, I love you. You fulfill me. You're a hideous reminder of how the country is. Talk radio, I love you. You fulfill me.
Flying monkeys on the air, flying monkeys everywhere. I do not like them on my station. I do not like them in my nation. It's more Mike Malloy.
It's more Mike Malloy. It is 10 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Bob Milton. Thank you, Bob. We appreciate it very much. This global climate change reality is really gotten inside my head. I don't know why I haven't been paying closer attention for the past 30 years, but does it not have you concerned? And again, it doesn't make any difference. I know a lot of people just can't do it. They're so far into denial about this, and I can understand why denial is, you know, one response to all this. you know, avoidance until it becomes impossible to avoid, and then denial once the reality is staring us all in the face. And I guess avoidance was what I practiced. The denial, though, I can't seem to get into that. I've tried that. I've tried to say, no. This is not happening. You know, cover my ears and go, la, 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 la. This is not happening. But it is. And I just wonder about the other people. I mean, if you think this is a liberal plot, really? I mean, are you that stupid? Really? That there's some plot to do what? I mean, what would be the goal? Destroy jobs? Are you serious? I mean, talk about denial. This is like your Elizabeth Kubler-Ross moment here, folks. At some point, there has to be acceptance, or not. I guess a lot of people just don't get to that point with anything. But this is so important. It's so massive. When you get right down to it, just about everything else becomes secondary. And some of the things that seem to catch our attention vis-a-vis this issue are not even, they shouldn't even be mentioned. It shouldn't even be a thought. Isn't it? I mean, what happens when super fires start to engulf Colorado Springs, Colorado? What happens to the people who live there? The central thought is to stop the fires because their lives, their homes, everything is about to be destroyed. So they become very focused, hoping against hope, begging in their hearts that the firefighters, what's left of them, since Colorado Springs and the state of Colorado decided, we don't need that, that those firefighters will be able to stop something that they knew existed when they built their homes in the forests that are ready to go up at any moment. So if people in Colorado Springs can organize their thoughts about, oh my God, this thing is about to destroy us, why can't we do that about global climate change? Is it because the forest fires in Colorado Springs were not there last week, so to speak, and all of a sudden they are there, and they're coming right now, and you can see them, and you watch the television, and you can see across the previous ridge over on the other side of that mountain, of that ridge, all these homes burned to white ash. So you know it's coming. Is that what it is? Whereas with global climate change, just can't get our minds around it because it's moving slowly, inexorably, but slowly. You know, they talk about global temperature, what Bill McKibben talks about in the Rolling Stone issue. If global temperatures rise 3 degrees Celsius, at that point, it's game over. Just literally, it's game over. And he uses plenty of science to explain what he means by that. But 3 degrees, I mean, we sit around here and we go, 3 degrees? Oh, goddamn, what's 3 degrees? What is that, 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit? I don't care about 3 degrees. What the hell 3 degrees do? Maybe that's it. But I have become so fixated on this, and I guess it's because I have children and grandchildren. Don't you? I mean, even if you don't you have nieces and nephews? Don't you have cousins? Don't you have little people, young people, somewhere in your extended family, anywhere, any place? And if not, you know, your blood family and your friends, don't you have friends that have little kids? Or, I mean, is that not, I mean, if we were all 70 years old, who cares, right? If everybody on earth was 70 years old, screw it, you know, let's party until the whole thing goes, pfft. But we're not. And you know, I have a 7-month-old granddaughter. And I look at her and sometimes and I think, you know, she's totally not conscious of what she's been born into. And in a very unknowable way, she's depending on us to let her have a life. And the same can be said for your grandchildren or your children or your nieces and nephews or your friends' children or whoever. These little innocent kids who don't have any idea what is happening. I don't know. This is something that just I can't seem to shake. If this subject bothers you, I guess since we're going to be talking about it a lot, I guess you'll need to find a new radio program. You know, denial and avoidance work up to a point. It's Joint Stretch. You know, I've said many times in this program that Republican office holders want people to die. And, you know, a lot of people go, oh, God, this Malloy, what a quack. What do you mean wants him to die? Of course they do. They do. Republicans, especially Republican politicians, they subscribe to death-centered religions. They subscribe to death-centered foreign policy. They subscribe to death-centered domestic policy. That's why the right-wingers are the first to start screaming about the Affordable Care Act, that it contained death panels. It's their, you know, their fantasy projected. And the latest example of this, the screaming and kicking like 2-year-olds from these governors who said they would not voluntarily expand Medicaid the way the Affordable Care Act wanted. The Affordable Care Act mandated the expansion. The Supreme Court said you can't do that, but it's still available. And the Medicaid option for the states would be paid for in full, 100%, for the first 3 years by the federal government. And then I think 80% or 90% of it would be paid by the federal government. And, of course, you get these freaks like Rick Perry or Rick Scott, you know, governors who have no more interest in leading their residents of their state than they do in choking to death on a chicken bone. They don't give a goddamn. They couldn't care less. And then you move a little bit to the right of them and you find the Republicans who are strictly pro-death. They're everywhere. A study published online today in the New England Journal of Medicine. According to the New York Times, found that when states expanded their Medicaid programs and gave more poor people health insurance, fewer people died. Now, the Republicans don't want fewer people dying. The Republicans want more people dying. They are death-centered. This study comes as the Times says the states are deciding whether to expand Medicaid by 2014 under the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court ruling last month effectively gave states the option of accepting or rejecting an expansion of Medicaid. And this expansion had been expected to add 17 million people to the program's roll. 17 million. The New England Journal study reflects a recent effort by researchers to get around the idea that people who choose to enroll may be sicker or they may be healthier and simply be more motivated to see doctors. They try to get around that problem and allow policymakers to make, and this is what right-wingers, religious or political, hate, evidence-based decisions. Right-wingers don't want evidence-based anything. They want Bible-based or politically ignorant-based or stupid-based or dumbassery-based, but they don't want evidence-based anything. Because once something is evidence-based, it means it's provable. And if it's provable, the right-winger's argument goes up in flames. So they don't want that. We don't want no stinking evidence. The Bible said, you know. An investigator on the study who served on former President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors said, quote, "I think it's a very significant study in part because of the paucity of studies that have really looked at health outcomes of insurance coverage. Actual mortality studies are few and far between. This is a well-done study. Timely, adds to the evidence base, and certainly should raise concern about the failure to expand Medicaid coverage to people most at risk of not getting the care that they need," end quote. Karen Davis. Catherine Baker, an investigator for the study, served on George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. She's the one who said this will allow policymakers to make evidence-based decisions. but no. The study, according to the Times, was conducted by researchers from Harvard School of Public Health. They analyzed data from three states that had expanded their programs in the last decade to cover a population not normally eligible for Medicaid. That would be adults without children or disabilities. And the new law also expands coverage to a similar population nationally. Researchers looked at mortality rates in those states, New York, Maine, and Arizona, 5 years before and after the Medicaid expansions and compared them with those in four neighboring states, Pennsylvania, Nevada, New Mexico, and New Hampshire, that did not put such expansions in place. The number of deaths for people aged 20 to 64, adults too young to be considered elderly by the researchers, the number of deaths decreased in the three states with expanded coverage by about 1,500 combined per year, after adjusting for population growth in those states. In the 5 years before the expansion of Medicaid, there were about 46,400 deaths per year, while in the 5 years after the expansion, there were about 44,900 deaths per year. When researchers adjusted the data for economic factors like income and unemployment rates and population characteristics like age, sex, race, and then compared those numbers with neighboring states, they estimated that the Medicaid expansions were associated with a decline of 6.1% in deaths, or about 2,840 per year for every 500,000 adults added. Now, this study should mean something. Now, to a lot of right-wingers, it won't mean anything. Because they say, well, I've got insurance, I don't need that crap. Well, what happens, right-winger, when you lose your job or the retirement money that you're getting all of a sudden dries up, or the retirement insurance you're getting all of a sudden is declared null and void because of a company bankruptcy or what have you? You know, you right-wingers think you're immune from what everybody else has to experience. You're not. You really aren't. Unless you're in that top 0.1%. Then you're immune from everything except your own death. That you're not immune from. That may come as a surprise to you, but it's the truth. But if you're not in that top 0.1%, if you're not in the top 1% or the top 5%, and you're a right-winger, do you think you're immune from this sort of thing? Do you think that this will never touch you, this will never harm you, never bother you? Are you serious? Do you exist in that kind of magical thinking? Wow. It must be pretty strange in your world. I damn sure would never want to even visit, much less live there. But here's the evidence-based information, so that policymakers can make evidence-based decisions. For you right-wingers, that is just total nonsense, isn't it? Huh? Of course it is.
Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Anybody want to call in? 877-996-2556. That's the number. Got an email here from Bob in Roswell, Georgia. It was a post. He sends me a post at McKibben's or the Climate Central website about the changes in Lake Superior. This is from Jack Burton in Two Harbors, Minnesota. As a lifelong resident of the North Shore of Lake Superior, I can tell you that the beaches are full of kids and adults taking full advantage of the fine swimming conditions. When I was a kid in the 1960s, a dip in Lake Superior in July would be life-threatening. A game we played in summer was to have four or five kids stand knee-deep in the lake and see who could stand it the longest. The cold water gave unbearable pain, and few kids lasted more than a minute or two. It has been decades now since we had large ice cover of Lake Superior in the winter. I cannot remember the last time open water froze over, the harbor freezing up, or some years, but never the open water. Again, when I was a kid, the lake froze up every winter. Large icebreakers would work in April and May to open shipping lanes. In the 1970s, we had ice conditions on the 5th of June. Now we no longer have ice conditions in January. To anyone living decades along the Lake Superior shoreline, climate change has been undeniable. The warming has been extreme and rapid the last 20 years. That's why nobody around here goes in for the climate change denial story. When you live it, it's hard to deny. Yes, it is. You want to leave that topic for a while tonight? Oh, just one more thing here. Andrew Friedman, writing at climatecentral.org, has an explanation, the story behind the record ice loss in Greenland that we were talking about the other night. 97% of the Greenland ice sheet, including normally frigid high-elevation areas, experienced some degree of melting. That's made international headlines, and for good reason. Such a widespread melt event has not occurred there since at least 1889, and may be yet another sign of the consequences of man-made climate change. But what does this event mean in the bigger picture of ice melt and sea level rise, and what led to it in the first place? And Friedman goes on to say, the widespread melt so far this season, while dramatic and worrisome to many climate scientists, does not necessarily mean that Greenland is headed for a far faster and more significant melt than scientists already anticipate. The current projections for sea level rise related to the melting of Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets is scary enough, with the likelihood that it will raise global sea levels from 2 to 6 feet by the end of the century. Greenland is the world's largest island, and it holds 680,000 cubic miles of ice. If all of this ice were to melt, and that won't happen anytime soon, but if it were, the oceans would rise by more than 20 feet. Jesus, God. Anyway, Greenland's ice has been melting faster than many scientists expected just a decade ago, spurred by warming sea and land temperatures, changing weather patterns, and other factors. He goes on to say that when they talk about this ice melt, they're talking about surface ice. They're not talking about ice that goes deep down into to the rock that is Iceland. And the melt event, he writes, comes during a summer season that also saw a rare event occur off the ice sheet in, I can't pronounce it, Greenland, which is a key transport and logistics hub for scientific expeditions studying the Greenland ice sheet. They also study meltwater runoff, turned a small river into raging rapids, and wiped out a bridge that had stood for at least 60 years. So the point of what he's trying to say is simply that while this event is unprecedented in the past 150 years, it doesn't mean that the ice that covers the rock of Greenland is melting. It means the, well, it is melting, but not down to where there's no more ice. It's just the surface. So what's to worry about, right? Normally, this time of year, the ice sheet surface in Greenland, the melt of that surface is about 40% of the vast area that it covers. This year it was 97%. And that's what got scientists' attention. So, not to worry, Greenland is not about to all of a sudden have no more ice. Nothing to worry about, right? All right, we'll be back after this break and take your phone call. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. 25 before the hour. Al is in Zebulon, North Carolina, listening online. Hello, Al.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
All right. I guess I call every couple of years or so.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I've been calling from South Florida and then Wilmington.
And now Zebulon.
Yeah.
I've been there. That's outside of Raleigh.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty far outside. Actually, it's on the it's on the east side, and it's one of the least developed parts of, at least outside of Zebulon.
You're over towards Wilson or Rocky Mount?
Right in between Raleigh and Wilson.
Yeah, okay.
South of Zebulon.
How did you wind up there?
Well, you know, that's part of why I called tonight. I moved from Wilmington because I've been into cycling all my life.
Recycling?
No, cycling.
Oh, cycling, biking.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd gotten into long-distance events that required me to do some climbing. And having spent a lot of time in South Florida and born and raised in Wilmington, there are no flats there. And so I thought, well, you know, I need to move to some place that has more hills than where I've been.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I've been, well, I grew up cycling as I was a paper boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been concerned with building exercise into my lifestyle. And cycling enables me to do a number of things. I can stay healthy. I can save money.
Right.
I don't pollute.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not screwing up the balance of payments and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, it's just a win-win-win.
Right.
In so many different ways. When I was in South Florida, I worked in Broward County Planning doing demographics. And I did a study on commute to work using census data.
Mm-hmm.
And discovered that most people live within 5 to 8 miles of where they work.
Right.
And did some computations. And if everybody that could ride that amount back and forth to work were to do that, then all of our energy problems would be solved.
Really?
Yes. Our balance of payments problems would be solved. Our health problems would be solved. All people have to do is get off their lazy behinds.
Well, that's true. That is very true. It would be a good thing if that were to happen, but realistically, what are the chances that are happening? Just like realistically, are the chances of people facing this global climate change for the reality that it is?
Well, you know, that's the problem.
Right.
I think I don't know whether I said when I did this study.
Mm-hmm.
It was back in the 80s.
In the 80s.
Yes. And I don't know that there's been one person, and I've ridden more than 6,500 miles this year.
Good Lord.
Okay, so it can be done. And by the way, I'm coming up on 67.
Hmm.
I don't take any kind of medication other than a little bit for arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm doing good.
You ought to try some NovaJoint, Al.
Well, I'm working on it. I've ordered some. And,
oh, good. Let me know how it works out. Well, now Zebulon, if I remember, that is kind of hilly. It's not mountainous, that's for sure. But it's very hilly there, right?
Yes, I mean there are some grades right outside of my house on the highway. They're up to 8, 9, 10%.
Okay, well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
And 4 or 5% is pretty common.
You know, for me to go from my living area to my work, I have to go down a 45-degree grade. That's steps into my basement.
Well, you know, that's a problem for people that work at home.
Well, no, I mean, I get plenty of exercise. I'm just saying,
well,
the one thing that I feel not smug or superior, but I feel good about is the fact that neither Kathy nor I have jobs where we have to commute, where we have to drive. And, you know, we live in the Atlanta area. There is a 1 cent sales tax coming up for a vote here on July 31st to try to untangle the mess that is Atlanta traffic. And they're trying to do it with rapid rail, some more rapid rail, some light rail, belt lines, but also expanding these damned freeways. When I first moved here 40 years ago, the interstates around Atlanta were at most 2 lanes, some of them 3 lanes. Now they're 14 lanes. And still in Atlanta, when you said the average commute is 8 or 10 miles, not here. The average commute here, well, I don't know what the average is, but so many people here, it takes them an hour to get to work, an hour and a half to get home, and God help you if there's a wreck on Interstate 75, 85, or 285, or I-20. Those are all four interstates that interconnect around Atlanta. When that happens, it's gridlock, man, and nothing moves. People don't get home till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. It's just astonishing.
Well, they would still be better off with a bicycle because that way they could get right through the traffic and not be hung up nearly as long.
That's right. Well, now, I'm about out of time here, but why did you go? You didn't go to Zebulon just for cycling.
Primarily, I also did it because it's closer to a more liberal part of the state.
Raleigh.
I didn't go as far as I needed to go.
You have family there? You just threw a dart at a map in North Carolina?
Well, I not exactly. I'd been looking around at the demographics of it, and I should probably be someplace like over in Chapel Hill.
Well, that's about the most liberal part of North Carolina, that's for sure.
I found a fixer-upper place, and the price was right, and I just couldn't turn it down.
Mm-hmm.
But now, the main message I have is that I'm mad as hell about what's happened to the environment.
Oh man, yeah.
I have been a scuba instructor. One of my specialties was coral reef ecology.
Hmm.
And when I see what's happening, what has happened to coral reefs.
Right.
I'm just mad as hell.
Yeah, I read something just the other day about how much longer we can expect before we have reef collapse all over the planet because of acidification of the oceans. And it's just impossible to read this stuff because nobody pays any attention. The policymakers are doing nothing.
Yeah, and that's what makes me suicidal. I'm not suicidal, but homicidal.
Yeah, I hear you.
Because you know, I look around and I see people that are causing the problem, and you know, they're the ones that if you were to hook them up to a dynamo, and plug that into the grid, and have them pedal their fat off, we wouldn't have an energy problem.
Man,
and when I go out now, I'm having a problem going out cycling because the weather is so bad. It's so hot that I can't go. And when I go out around here, it's pig crap, chicken crap.
Oh yeah, the stink is awful.
And the fumes from the pesticides on all the tobacco crops around here.
You better
from all these good Christian farmers around here.
Al, I got a news flash. You better pick someplace other than Zebulon.
You're right. Yeah, I think I gotta move.
Finish that fixer upper and sell it, man.
Yeah.
Hey, Al, I gotta leave there. Thank you. Don't be a stranger. Call again. I'm glad you called in tonight. Okay.
Thank you, man. I enjoy it.
All right, sir. Take care. Yeah, I remember Zebulon, North Carolina. Kathy and I have got, we swim our laps. We have to hit the pool, by 10 o'clock in the morning. our neighborhood pool, outdoor pool. First of all, there's nobody in it at that time. But secondly, if we wait here in the metro Atlanta area, if we wait until the afternoon, the air is so befouled with auto exhaust and ozone and the rest of it. I mean, I think every single day here in the Atlanta area has been an ozone alert day where they recommend that people, that the air quality is not good for anybody. Not just people who have breathing problems or youngsters or, but they'll tell you that, if you get out and get the exercise before noon, you'll survive. I guess.
And it says here the crazy horse was killed while he was trying to escape. And it was sometime last September, and it don't give the exact date. Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
Ten before the hour. Tim is in Detroit, listening on XM. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Mike. Before I get to my main point, I remember back in the 1980s when I used to visit up north, as we call the UP in Michigan, in the peninsula.
Right.
And it borders Lake Superior up there. And, you know, I mean, I think I might have swum the lake a couple of times, and I was there for a long time, and it was very, very cold.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the 1980s, which shows, at least anecdotally, I mean, global warming is just incredibly increasing. So we all know this. The scientists know it. More data keeps coming out from all over the world. And yet, I listen to not just national news, but the international news. And you have all these countries from Eastern Europe to various small Asian nations to African nations, and they're drilling for oil everywhere now.
Well, you know, that's one of the points that McKibben makes. He refers to these countries. Venezuela is a good example. Russia is a good example. That they are essentially huge oil or huge carbon-producing entities because it is the main source of revenue for them. I think Nigeria is that way. Venezuela is that way. Russia, the wealth that Russia is enjoying is because of their oil business. And another point he made, if all the carbon that is still locked up is released, you know, locked up in the permafrost or in rocks or down where the oil is under the sea, if it's all released, it is an extinction moment. That's the end of everything. Everything stops.
Some of that's begun to get released. I think in the tundra area, there's a lot of methane down there in the peat bog.
Right. And methane, it's my understanding, is more destructive to the atmosphere than CO2. So, you know, what are you going to do? How do you talk to a Chavez or a Putin or an Obama or whoever the hell the head of China is? Or India? How do you talk to these leaders and say, look, this has got to stop, you know, buying things, making things, the accumulation of wealth is not what human life is about. It's not what planetary life is about. How much junk do you need to accumulate? How big of a house? How many cars before it's enough? You know, it's madness, Tim.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this, and I know you've said, and my friend Peter Werby has said, that we have to really start protesting this capitalism from the bottom. And I agree with that fundamentally, but I keep looking at the world populations. And not to be judgmental, but many people really want this this fossil fuel dream, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how in the hell you begin to teach people to get off that. Because, you know, you have the media, the whole media promotes this. Okay, if you want a better life, get a new car. If you want a better life,
mm-hmm.
you know, get air conditioning. If you want a better life, get a bigger house. And,
right.
and this is international, not just in America.
Right, right.
So the average person, unless they're aware, they're just gonna buy into it. You know, they send their kids to college, supposedly if they can afford it, to get ultimately more things, which produce more carbon. And it's very daunting to talk to the average person, at least I have found, to get them. You know, when I try to do that, people accuse me of preaching poverty.
Right,
okay, well,
right.
I'm against progress.
Yeah, class warfare, that too.
Yeah, I'm not talking about outright Republicans. I'm talking about people who claim to be non-political.
Mm-hmm.
And they buy into this. Well, of course I should have an extra car if I can afford it. Why are you against that? And you try to tell them, okay, if you do that and the next person does it, the next person does it, you just keep increasing the level of carbon dioxide in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And that has consequences. And people sort of look at you and go, Yeah, that's fine, but I, you know, don't tell me what to buy.
I know.
I mean, look at the crap Bloomberg has faced just to limit some soda drinks.
I know.
You see people going, well, he can't do that. Oh, who is going to do it then? So it's just very outrageous. I don't know.
It's just crazy to me. I can understand in a manner of speaking, the ridiculousness of what Michael Bloomberg is suggesting. 16-ounce sugary drink should be banned. Okay, what about 16-ounce Big Macs, whatever the hell they are? What about 16-ounce milkshakes? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, people need to be educated that they're destroying their bodies. But then make a personal decision. Do they want to keep destroying or not? But global climate alteration and planetary heating is not something that you can say, well, you know, I'm not going to go get a 16-ounce Coke, so I'm okay.
Uh-huh.
You know, it takes every single government on earth to come to terms with the fact that if we do not stop it now, and even stopping it now, this production of CO2, even continuing this mad race to extinction, if we stopped it now, we would still have to rely on science to figure out a way to survive over the next 150 years until perhaps the whole global climate change thing starts to stabilize and possibly calm down a little bit.
You know who Wasserman is?
Who?
Wasserman. He wrote a book years ago called Solartopia.
No, I'm not familiar with that
and,
at all.
Actually, Werby has interviewed him I don't know how many times, and he's pretty good, and I think he's scientific, too. He wrote this book called Solartopia, and he thinks that by 2030, if we got our act together, we could produce a world where our principal source of energy would be the sun.
18 years?
Yeah, he thinks it can be done. I mean, maybe you can find him on the Internet. His last name is Wasserman. I think his first name is Bill.
Wasserman, okay.
Yeah, and his book is called Solartopia. I think he's updated it too.
Okay.
And I think he's for real. He seems to know what he's talking about.
What do you think his first name is?
I think it's Bill Wasserman.
Bill. Okay.
I know his last name is Wasserman.
I'll try to find it. Hey, we're out of time, Tim.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you calling. Okay.
Take it easy.
All right. You too. Take care. Third hour coming up. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. past the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Alma Andrew. And her message, Dad, you died 1 year ago. I so wish we were together. Your youngest, always, Alma. Thanks, Alma. Sad message. Thanks, Alma. It's Harvey Wasserman did some checking during the break. And, yeah, he's the author of Solartopia. I'll have some more on that here in just a second. But Antonio's been holding on forever in Milwaukee. Hello, Antonio.
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Not bad at all. I enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I actually stumbled upon it. I listened to 127
yeah.
all the time. And just one night I was on my way home and I was like, man, this guy is, you were going on one of your rants though. But I was like, man, this guy's pretty funny, but I like his past.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad you found us.
But yeah, I want to talk to you about I guess the NRA and everything that happened in Colorado, and I've just been listening for the last couple of days about people giving their opinion about it, and mostly everybody that says we don't need tougher gun laws, and it's just funny to me because they always associate criminals with guns, and any of the shooting, the Arizona shooting, the Virginia Tech shooting, Columbine, these guys weren't criminals. They were just probably just insane college students or high school students.
Well, that's a good argument for if somebody wants to own a tank, go ahead, but you have to pass a background check. You have to provide documentation that you're not insane, maybe a statement from a psychologist or a psychiatrist. Look at what people have to go through just to get a license to cut hair. Look at what people have to go through just to get a license to work in a butcher shop or work as a butcher in a supermarket. Look what people have to go through just to form a corporation, and yet the pro-gun people in this country don't even want gun owners to go through what a hairdresser has to go through. That's madness. That's goddamn insanity. That makes no sense whatsoever. If somebody wants to own a semi-automatic or a fully automatic assault rifle, go ahead. But before you get it, you're going to have to prove to an authority that you're stable, that you're not insane. What the hell you want it for? Oh, I know, to go hunting rabbits. You know, what you want it for, why it's so important to you, and if you can prove that you're not going to go nuts and start wiping out people, okay, if you have to have a mega death toy, I guess you're entitled. On the other hand, no, you're not. What the hell is that stuff available in this society for anyway? I mean, who are we at war with? I'll tell you who people are at war with. Men who buy those things are at war with their own penises. They're in a death struggle with their own sexual organs. Like, why aren't you bigger? I'm going to go get me a 80-round clip. God damn it, that'll make me a man. I'm sorry, Antonio. You're talking to the wrong person about this. You really are. I just can't take it. I got to go. Thanks, Antonio. Appreciate you checking in. You know, I've said it a million times. I remember a different lifetime when I filled out one of those little forms in American Rifleman and got my membership card from the NRA. And because I was hunting not bunnies, not Bambies, I was hunting pheasants, and just for the hell of it. Plus, I was doing target shooting with a .22 caliber rifle. And then got into 12-gauge. Well, started with a 16-gauge, then 12-gauge. And then for a number of reasons, got a couple of handguns. And when the NRA went crazy and decided,
I'll tell you what we're going to do. From here on out, we're going to elect a board of directors that's just certifiably goddamn nuts. And we're going to call ourselves the NRA, and we're just going to go crazy. You want to come along? And I and a lot of other people just said no. But I mean, the idea of gun ownership, okay. Yeah, I own a couple. Yeah, I know. But the gun that I use the most is an air rifle that uses those .025 caliber pellets. And what do I use it for? I shoot the living hell out of these tree rats that come around my house and try to infest everything and leave their filthy droppings around. Pow, pow. Yeah. And I also have been known to carry a handgun for the reasons I've said. I mean, when you've been threatened as many times as I have, you know, I don't carry one because, I've got a gun. If you meet me, of course, in this weather, there's no place to hide it. But if you meet me on a normal average day, you wouldn't know I'm carrying a gun. You'd have no idea. I especially like these freaks who, yeah, I'm going to carry mine on my hip. I'm going to get a holster. You see this? How do you like that Glock? Isn't that a son of a bitch? How about that? Am I a man or what? Am I powerful or what? Huh? Where's something I can shoot? I can't, you know, I can't stand this whole gun thing. I just can't take it. Guns do kill people. They really do. They kill lots of people. And these street sweepers and these weapons that you, I mean, as fast as you can pull the trigger, you can be killing people one after another or wounding them. And if you get a fully automatic, hell, all you have to do is just hold the trigger. Oh, look at all the goddamn blood. Look at that. Look at all the hair and teeth and eyeballs plastered up against the theater wall. Look over here. Look how many people we wiped out in the school cafeteria. Goddamn, look at me. I just wiped out a whole university. Ah! I don't even like to talk about it. I don't like to talk about it. This society is insane on so many different levels. And the whole gun thing is just another manifestation of that complete breakdown, that complete loss of any connection to reality whatsoever. So you crazy sons of bitches out there that want to own your semis and your fullies and all this other stuff, you go right ahead. You go right ahead. And the day when your little 9-year-old accidentally blows her head off, well, you know, that's just the price you pay, right? That's just the way it goes. Or the day when your old lady's had enough of you and commits suicide by putting the barrel in her mouth and pulling the trigger, well, that's just because, you know, that's the price of having a gun. Or when you get all liquored up one time and you point it in the wrong direction and you blow a hole in your chest about the size of a goddamn number 10 tomato can, well, that's just the price you pay for that precious Second Amendment, right? You sick bastards. I'm so sick of it. Do some commercials, Kathy, before I lose my mind.
Channel.
It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. From Michael in New Mexico, isn't it bizarre that this country defends the right to carry guns, which can kill the owner and others, but actively denies the right to carry an ounce of grass, which to date hasn't killed anyone? Maybe hemp growers Washington, Jefferson, and Madison should have demanded a constitutional amendment. make that the Second Amendment, right? Where are we? Oh, yeah, before we come back to your calls here, Harvey Wasserman is who our caller was talking about. And he says we have a global crisis. It has a solution. The solution is winnable. And winning requires a middle path of action that is both nonviolent and nonstop. There are technological solutions to the crisis, but they demand political action. So here are the eight green steps to a sustainable world. Number one, ban waste and war. Nothing may be produced that cannot be fully recycled or that will not completely biodegrade. This includes weapons whose sole purpose is death and destruction. Two, maximize efficiency and conservation. From energy to building materials, food to fiber, water to paper, our resources must be preserved. Sustainable consumption and wasteful industries must be made appropriate and efficient, starting with a mass transit system. Number three, transcend fossils and nukes. King Kong, that would be coal, oil, nukes, and gas, must take its place in the compost heap of history. Four, convert to renewables, solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, waves, current, sustainable biofuels and their green siblings are proven, profitable, and have time on their side. Five, go organic. Six, transform the corporation. Our most powerful and destructive institution claims human rights without human responsibilities. Corporate charters must require social service, ecological accountability, and establish a barrier between capitalism and cannibalism. Seven, assure social democracy. Universal hand-counted paper ballots and curbs on the power of money to sway elections are the essential of global democracy. So on and so on. Number eight, empower women, control population. Mostly things in Harvey Wasserman's list of what's required for solutions to the crisis, most things that simply are common sense. Oh, God. Yes, David.
Hey, Mike.
Yes, David.
Why is it that you can own a gun, but nobody else is smart enough to own a gun?
Now, who said that? Who said, now, I'm going to drop you down. I'm not going to listen to that garbage. I never said that. I said, go ahead and order any kind of a goddamn gun you want. So when you call my program and you come into my place of business and your mouth is just flapping like crazy with stuff I never said, you're gone. You're out of here. Now, if you ever call this program again, just try to remember that. If you want to be on the air, if you want to have an argument, if you want to do whatever you want to do, if you want to make a point, fine. But don't start your call by suggesting declaring I said something that I didn't. Because you know what happens then? You're gone, okay? And you can call back until your goddamn finger drops off. I don't care, but you're not going to go on the air. Now, after you've had a chance to think it over, maybe 6-7 months from now, if you want to call and make a point about gun ownership or whether or not you think I'm a hypocrite, fine. But that's not how you start your call. What's wrong with you people? What's wrong with you right-wingers? How many times have I had to smack your asses? How many times have I had to give you a case of radio red ass when you do that? I keep telling you over and over again, don't do that. But you don't listen, so, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Pow, pow, pow! That's the sound of me smacking your bottom. Because if you're going to act like some out-of-control, nasty-ass 10-year-old, I'm probably going to smack your bottom. They just won't learn.
I don't know why. They just won't learn. Why do I think I have a right to own a weapon and nobody else does? That's so far from what I said is to render your whole phone call asinine. And, you know, there's enough real things to worry about except acute dumbassery. We'll be back after the break. Stick around.
Back to Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Alma Andrew, whose message, Daddy, you died 1 year ago. I so wish we were together. Your youngest, always, Alma. Thank you, Alma. Dwayne is in Winnipeg, Canada. Hello, Dwayne.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. I just want to jump in on this gun control conversation here, if I could.
Okay.
Well, basically, first of all, I just want to start by saying I'm not against gun ownership. Because, I mean, there's a lot of people here that do own guns for, you know, hunting primarily.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with guns, rifle, shotgun, you know, 22, that sort of thing. But it seems to me like when you ask all the people that I know why you have a gun, you're normally going to get the answer for hunting. But it seems like down in the States, when you're asked why you have a gun, it seems to be always for protection.
Right, exactly.
And it's like what are you being protected from other than your fellow man who has, what, another gun, right?
Right.
So, I mean, just to me doesn't make any sense, because, like, I heard the other day on the radio, it was some right-wing guy talking about, he wrote a book about how everybody should have a gun, and that would reduce, you know, deaths by guns, but the logic behind that is so totally screwed up, because, yeah, I mean...
It is. It's sick.
Like, I mean, if you were to say, like, let's say, change that to swords. If people were being killed by swords, so then if someone were to propose a solution, well, then let's give everybody a sword, and then the death by swords will stop. It's just so, like, unbelievably illogical that I can't believe someone would even come up with that stupid argument.
This is a country, Dwayne, where we are going to continue to make it easy for our little kids to stumble into daddy's gun collection, pull the trigger and blow the little boy's head off or kill the little daughter. That's just the way the gun nuts look at this. The gun nuts want this to happen. There are some of us, and I put myself in this category, who definitely have felt threatened to the point, and I've told the story before, where I was told by the Atlanta Police Department terrorist unit 20 years ago that I should carry a gun. And for me,
I mean, that is so not me. Like you, I grew up around hunting rifles or shotguns. And the hunting rifles were not occasionally come across a 30 caliber, but most of them were 22s because we were after small game. We weren't after deer or a mountain goats or bear. You know, it was small game. So the only time I ever saw a 30 caliber was when I got a little bit older and actually fired one and, you know, to find out what it felt like. But if there are people who definitely feel threatened because they have gotten death threats, that's a little bit different from...
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, it just seems like the whole idea of owning a gun is totally different in Canada and the States.
It is, right.
In Canada, if you ask someone, like, you know, like, why do you have a gun? Well, it's for a practical reason. It's for hunting because we hunt goose and we hunt deer and we hunt moose and we actually go out. But it seems like... If you ask an American why they own a gun, well, it's my constitutional right. Well, what's the practical reason why you actually own the weapon?
I know.
I mean, other than protect, like your main objective here is to protect yourself and to shoot another human being. Like, I just don't get it. Like, I mean,
well, Michael Moore explored all this, the difference between gun ownership in Canada and the United States, in his movie Bowling for Columbine, and
yes,
he pretty much
that was amazing.
Yeah, pretty much made the same point that you're making. And,
well, yeah, like I mean, in the Windsor, Detroit, I believe it was right. But almost the same population, almost same weapons ownership per capita, but the difference in murder rate was like, is unbelievably much higher in Detroit, right?
Yeah, from Detroit, you go across the Ambassador Bridge. What is it? 5 miles, and you're in Windsor. Somebody tell me the difference between the two cities. Geographically, there's 5 miles, but the difference in attitude where it concerns guns, like you point out, is north and south, east and west. It's just insane. Well, I hear what you're saying, Dwayne, and I appreciate you checking in, okay?
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir. Now, let me make something real clear here. I'm not going to take any more calls on guns. I just am not. I hate this topic. I did this 20 years ago. I used to get into this discussion. You better tell the guy on line one, Kathy, that I'm not going to talk about guns or gun control. It's pointless. It's like a mad dog chasing his own tail. I'm just not going to do it. So if you want to talk about guns, call a different program or gun control or the Second Amendment or any of that stuff. I just don't do that anymore. I really don't. I did that topic, talked about that so many times with the same result, nothing. People who do not believe in the proliferation of weapons in this country, like me, are on one side. The people who insist they have a constitutional right to carry a goddamn flamethrower if they feel like it are on the other side, and never the twain shall meet, and I'm just not interested in even talking about it, okay? Not even talking about around the edges. Not even talking about it indirectly. I just don't go there. Because this country has a population that is so sick and so insane in so many different ways. In so many different ways. I'm sorry, that's just it. I'm not talking about everybody. I'm talking about a hefty percentage of the people who live in the United States are out of their goddamn minds. And they act out. They act out their insanity. They act it out in their churches. They act it out in their attitudes. They act it out in their voting patterns. They act it out in their gun craziness. They act it out in immediately running out and buying guns after there's been a mass killing. I mean, this is a sick society. And if you don't agree with that, I really don't care. I really don't. I couldn't care less if you don't agree with it. This is a sick, effed up society on so many different levels. And our attitudes toward women, our attitudes where it concerns this religious hokum, it's a sick, messed up country. To the degree that it's sicker than other countries, I have no idea. I just know that I live in what Greg Palast absolutely described as an armed madhouse. So, no gun talk. Not on this program. There's all kinds of radio programs that would love to talk to you about how the goddamn colored guy in the White House is taking away your guns. Or it's a liberal plot. Go talk until your ass falls off. I'm not the least bit interested. Gary is in Minneapolis listening on KTNF. Hello, Gary.
Hey, I just wanted to talk about the right to buy a large drink in New York City. That's one of the things I wanted to bring up. But one of the things I think is funny is that, you know, why if he wants to go there, what about Starbucks? Because some of those coffees have as many calories.
Or more. Twice as many.
And then I was watching Jay Leno a few weeks ago, and they had Meghan McCain, of all people, on there, and they brought the issue up. And one of the things she was talking about was decriminalization or legalization of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying that if they implemented that law in New York City about the soda,
mm-hmm.
the fine for that would probably be $200, and the fine for smoking or being caught with like a small amount of marijuana would only be $100.
What did I just say, Gary? We live in a pretty sick society, okay?
Yep.
I mean, to try to legislate against a 16-ounce drink, okay, how about this? I go into a store, into a fast food joint or wherever, and I buy 2 8-ounce drinks. Woo!
Yep.
Have I broken the law?
And then you can do that at the restaurant anyway. You can just go and buy two. So
Bloomberg occasionally has some good ideas, but he's like a lot of billionaires. He gets an idea buzzing around his head like flies around a dung heap, and he starts to take himself seriously. He starts to think that, oh yeah, this is really a good idea, when it's the dumbest ass idea I've ever heard of. Banning 16-ounce sugary drinks. That's madness. Now, we don't drink sugary drinks in this little family. Molly doesn't drink them. But if somebody else wants to drink a goddamn gallon of Coca-Cola, go ahead. I mean, drink it until your gut explodes. Isn't that the 90th amendment or something to the Constitution? You have a right to drink soft drinks until your gut explodes. I think it is. Gary, I have to leave it there. I know you wanted to say something about Chris Hedges, but I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. We'll be right back. This hour has been sponsored by Alma Andrew. Thank you, Alma. Her message, Daddy, you died 1 year ago. I so wish we were together. Your youngest, always, Alma. Thanks, Alma. Harry is in Washington, D.C., listening online. Hello, Harry.
Hi, Mike. I just wanted to let you know, I'm embarrassed to say I only discovered your program about 9 months ago.
No problem.
But I'm a very big fan.
Thank you.
And admire your intellectual honesty. And I wanted to bring up something related to, you know, you're talking about the Bill McKibben article.
Right.
You know, I think he's a very heroic man. And you know, I'm going to have to go read the whole article. But I was also struck by an article earlier this week written by Chris Hedges. And called The Careerists.
Mm-hmm.
And in part what he's saying is, well, I'll just read you the first few sentences. He says, the greatest crimes of human history are made possible by the most colorless human beings. They are the careerists, the bureaucrats, the cynics, They do the little chores that make vast, complicated systems of exploitation and death a reality. And he goes on from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's one of my favorite writers right now, absolutely.
Yeah, and I admire him a great deal. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I believe what he said. I do agree with what he's saying here. And there are a lot of people like that. And, I live here in Washington, D.C., and there's certainly a lot of bureaucrats and sort of technical people kind of keeping the system going. But, you know, there's also the fact that we sort of have these systems, and, you know, in a sense, these systems also shape, as social psychologists would say, you know, they shape how people behave.
Right.
And so in terms of, I know you've talked about, you know, your feelings about, you know, social democracy many times on your show, and I do agree with that myself. I'm wondering, you know, in terms of Bill McKibben's article, how do we get, you know, these large systems or even these systems where you have people sort of, you know, doing the technical work of keeping them going, and how do we get this? I mean, I'm befuddled myself as to how we sort of make these kind of
well, McKibben's, and not to pass the buck, but McKibben's article goes into depth about this. It's not as complex or as complicated as it sounds to me, it sounds to you, because that's always been, you know, the one question I get a lot and the one question I have to ask myself. Okay, if the current system is so horrible, and it is, and we want to change it, and a lot of us do, and we don't believe in violent revolution, which most of us don't, then how do we change it?
Yeah.
And I think we have to go back to the systems of passive resistance. Chris Hedges advocates massive, nonviolent civil disobedience as a way of bringing the machine to a stop. My feeling about that is it doesn't even have to go that far. It can just be people refusing to participate. Switching the system over from what it is currently to social democracy or democratic socialism is going to, there would be an interim period where the crazies with their guns and a lot of miscreants in this society, a lot of the psychos that have been produced by the society would really have a field day.
Yeah.
And, but we have to go back if I'm only talking about white males now, if you go back to the Revolutionary War, the same thing happened. The white males who had come to this country or who'd been born here, who decided to set up the United States of America. It was going to be based on genocide, slavery, and rights only granted to white landowning males.
Yep.
There was a period of transition and violence there, too, until the British finally, after about 40 years, they finally gave it up.
Mm-hmm.
But it took two major wars, you know, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812.
Right.
And so that the white males, the white male landowners, could get what they wanted, which was whatever it was they wanted. So there is that period. They went from monarchy to a democratic capitalism.
Yeah,
and the transition was bloody and violent. So I don't know how there would be a period in this country that would not be very disrupted if we make a move from the kind of capitalism that we have and the control over our system by the corporatists to a more equitable and fair system, which would be democratic socialism. It's one thing to be a theoretician. It's something else again to be someone who has to start, you know, stop these wheels turning, start those wheels to commence turning. And that will take people much smarter than I, people who are truly social scientists. Again, it's one thing to lay out the theory. It's something else again to come up with the application. So I'm hoping that the idea that put out there in 1964 by Mario Savio will eventually take root, where people will understand that the military-industrial complex, the banking system, the pharmaceutical system, the private education system, the fossil fuel energy system, all of these different systems are absolutely, totally, and completely destroying us.
I agree.
And we've got to make a change. I think it was Mao or Stalin or somebody that said that power
comes from the barrel of a gun. I that's revolutionary talk. I don't think that it's necessary to go that far.
Right.
But it's a conundrum. It's a real problem. Harry, I wish I had answers. I wish somebody would give me some. I continue to look for those answers that Bill McKibben has, that Chris Hedges has, that Greg Palast has, that
right.
Michael Moore has. And I'm sorry just to be naming men there, because there are a lot of women who have answers, too. Those are the
right.
four that pop into my mind. I hope we reach some kind of an understanding. Harry, I've got to leave it there. Here comes the theme music. We're out of here for tonight. Thanks a lot, pal.
Well, thanks so much.
All right. I appreciate you checking in. I hope you call again. Well, that's it for me tonight. I'll see you tomorrow. All right? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.